Hello, folks. Welcome to another episode of Conversations with Annie and Kate. Hi, Annie.
Hey, Kate, how are you going?
I am well. And our lovely guest tonight is Van Badham, who I now know an awful lot about. I had no idea that she was a writer, a critic, a trade unionist, a feminist, an activist, an occasional broadcaster, and an internationally award-winning theatre maker. And I knew she was one of Australia's most controversial social commentators. But I just had no idea you had all of this background in theatre and stuff.
Yeah, that's actually my life. That's my job. That's my primary source of income. I find it very strange that people know me as this sort of media entity, because I sort of wander through the media going, I'm not of these people. That's not what I do. I'm a theatre person, and I'm a full-on theatre person. And yeah, I mean, it hasn't been the best couple of years to be a theatre person, can I say, like, quite honestly. You know, this whole invisible killer virus thing has been a bit of a career downer. But really, that's what I do. I wrote my first professional play when I was 15, and I trained as an actor from the age of 14 and went to university and was a theatre major there. I lectured in dramaturgy for years at University of Wollongong, at Monash, at the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art. Like, that's actually what I do. And it is still very strange to me that I've ended up doing anything else with my life.
Well, it's lovely to have you, and really interesting to discover these other parts of you. So thank you for coming on board.
I think it says something about the internet that it, for something that's supposed to be about this sort of live stream of individual consciousnesses, you know, this great democratization of knowledge, it's actually surprisingly easy to find yourself fragmented. Yeah. And the idea, like, I've been friends with you on Twitter for what, 8 years, and you haven't seen the theatre part of my life, which I would say, you know, dominates my waking thought as well as most of my working hours. I had a meeting with a dramaturg and a director today. You know, I spent my weekend with one of my musical collaborators working on a new project. I spent all of last week writing songs for another musical that I'm working on with my work husband, who's the composer who I've done 5 musicals with. And yeah, so it is very strange to me that people don't know that.
My completely nerdy musical brain, because I love musicals. I love them dearly.
That's because they are the best.
But please introduce us to your dog, please.
This is Germanicus.
Hi, Germanicus.
Yes, he's the conqueror of the tribes of the Rhine, and he is so good. He's a good boy.
He's such a good boy. Well, look at that. That's a very epic nose.
Oh, yes. He's got a proud little hound face. He's quite theatrical, our Germanicus. He must be the centre of attention. I don't know if you've met Dachshunds before. they always find their light, as we say, in the theatre.
Perfectly reasonable. Now, hey, let's, Kate, you and I need to obviously do our housekeeping. Kate, what are you drinking?
I am drinking a gin and tonic in my new crystal glasses, because I realised that why shouldn't I have nice things while I'm still alive?
Just in general, as a thought process, I think that's perfect. I am on a glass of, it's a very drinkable Penfold Canuga Hill. I don't know whether you have a drink in your hand.
I do. I abjure the demon drink. I do not drink alcohol, but I am very partial to an afternoon cup of tea. And I have this beautiful TWS haute couture tea, which is sort of very light and toasty, which I have a big pot of, and I've been drinking it.
That sounds fabulous. So Kate and I are big fans of Yorkshire tea from the UK, but the specific gold blend.
Ah, yes. I lived in Yorkshire, so I went to university there. So to study.
Really? Whereabouts? Sorry, I'm being a nerd, because that's where I grew up.
Yeah, I went to the University of Sheffield.
Good old Sheffield.
Yeah, it was pretty good. I had rather a good time. And I'm very up. It's so funny, because I lived in the UK for 10 years, and because my first year there was spent in Sheffield, I think of myself as Northern.
Like, well, no, you are.
Yeah, I feel pretty.
This is how it goes.
I described Sheffield to friends as like Wollongong, which is where I'm from, with snow. So.
Actually, yes. I can see that. So I grew up in Huddersfield, which is a couple of towns over,
I have
not
friends from
far.
Huddersfield, yes.
And I've been to Wollongong many, many, many times, and I can see that analogy. I think that works.
Yeah. So I went there as an exchange student in 2001, and all of the steel universities around the world have these various relationships. So
Right.
Wollongong, Bochum in Germany, the University of Sheffield, I think it's Urbana-Champaign in Illinois. There's a whole range of them who have these exchange relationships. So that's where I could go. And as an exchange student, I just loved it. The theatre department was intense. And what really sold me on going to Sheffield was they did a production of Richard III, which had 300 undergraduates set fire to a hill fort. And I was like, I'm definitely going. Like, that's where I belong. Now,
All right, I mean,
if the screen shifts around, it's because Germanicus has decided to put his head on the mouse pad.
all of these things are allowed and indeed encouraged. So here's we have a couple of set questions. None of them are particularly sort of challenging as in hard work, but hopefully they might help you think a little bit. So my first one for you would be, if you could go back to yourself, your former younger self, at any time in your younger self, what advice would you give yourself and why?
Look, that's a really fraught question because my life is pretty good at this point, and I'm very much in my middle age because I'm 47 now. I'm at the point of going, it was all worthwhile because it got me to this point, and this is a really nice part of my life to enjoy. And I have made some really good decisions. My partner and I live in regional Australia, which is where we're from and where we belong, and I travel the world to come back to the place where I started, effectively. I'm in a really good relationship. I have a really cute dog. I do a lot of gardening. Like, those kind of things are really important, and my career's in a really interesting place. So if we recognize that everything leads us to this moment, I would say just roll with it. If I met a version of myself and saw the trajectory they were on, I would say, particularly to a young heterosexual woman, your love life is not more important than your education or your career. So I, was boy crazy as a teenager and as a young adult, and I got really into the theatrics of all kinds of, crazy youthful relationships. A lot of them were really fun. But what I now see in retrospect, which I didn't see at the time, were that the boys who used to sort of leave the pub early or not turn up to the party or, flake on various social engagements had their priorities in line. So I think particularly of one guy who I had this sort of on-off thing with, who was reading the books and going to the shows and meeting the people and doing the work while I was spending hours putting on makeup and making myself look fabulous. And, it didn't matter to him that he didn't look fabulous. It mattered to him that the next door would open and he'd get the next career progression. And sometimes I think, like, of the time that I could have spent just reading more, like, there are still some great works of literature that I haven't read, and I could have read them when instead I was getting my hair done. You know what I mean? Like,
Right.
and really, as you get older, you realize that those years as a young person, you don't get them back. And before things get serious, before your parents get sick, before you're trying to have a family or dealing with not being able to have a family or any of those things, before things get really serious and complicated and it's about incomes and responsibilities and the rest of it, that's your opportunity to read as many books and see as many films and go to as many exhibitions and just absorb the world. I mean, I did make some really good decisions as a young person, and traveling was the major one. And I don't regret that, I mean, at all. Like, that was really how I got my education. I got a great education at the University of Wollongong, but and at the University of Sheffield, but I really got to put it into perspective when I travelled. And I
Yeah.
travelled on my own, and I went to live in countries where I didn't know anybody and forced myself to acclimatise. And that experience of travel filled in a lot of gaps, and I'm really grateful that happened. The trade-off, of course, was that I lived in absolutely horrendous poverty for years. My parents didn't have any money. My dad was a club manager and my mother was a steno in the public service. And they came from pretty hard scrabble backgrounds, the two of them. I mean, they did what they could and they were incredibly supportive, but I didn't have a safety net. Like, I didn't have, you know, my parents didn't buy me an apartment. And, you know, I certainly met people in my travels who were like, oh yes, I did it rough. My parents had to buy me a bedsit kind of thing, which I always found kind of stunning. And it meant that particularly when I was in London and trying to make it in my theatre career, there were weeks that I lived on beans. At one point I was subletting this disgusting bedsit I lived in to a friend of mine who was doing fairly unspeakable things in it for money because I had none. And while he was using the apartment, I was sleeping behind the couch at my musical partner's house because I just didn't have enough money to pay the rent. And, you know, I worked in, like, I delivered newspapers in London and I was a scientific test subject for money and worked behind a bar, like, knackering until 2 o'clock in the morning hours and then up again at seven. I used to sometimes sleep in the, if it was really cold, if it was snowing in London and I'd done a late shift to the bar and I had an early one in the morning, I used mm-hmm. to sleep under the coats that the customers left behind in the wine cellar in this sort of ancient London pub where I worked, and it was fairly terrifying. But I did it because I was trying to get shows on and learn my craft as a theatre maker and do the rest of it. And it, I mean, it took it out of me. Like, it was a really difficult experience. And eventually London got too hard. When Cameron got elected, the money that had been in, the money that had sort of been supporting me in various jobs and programs I could get myself into. So I did a lot of work at the BBC and I had this job at Lambda and I was picking up bits and pieces at LIPA, which is Liverpool Institute of Performing Arts, various places, and getting the odd grant and just enough money to sort of only have to do 6 weeks working in a special ed school or only a few weeks living behind the couch at Johnny Billiner's house and things like that. But when the government changed, that money started to disappear and they certainly weren't going to give it to an Australian. And it got really difficult and there was more waitressing than there was work, theatre work. And I got really sick. There was a particularly bleak winter. It must have been in like 2010, 2011. And I was working in a wine bar as a, you know, sommelier, hospo sort of, yeah, it was, and everybody was like, oh my God, what are you getting paid? And I was like £8 an hour. And I was like, oh my God, that's fantastic. £8 an hour, you know, which was amazing. Like a cab home cost me like 2.5 hours of work. And I just costed everything in terms of that kind of income. And the snow was bitter. Like I was walking through snow that was up to my chest on the way to and from work if I wasn't sleeping in the cellar. And the power got cut off and I didn't have enough money to get the power put back on. And then I got sick, like, and I got really, really sick and was like coughing up blood and I was hospitalized. And it was just, it was really the end of my time there. And at the same time, you had those horrendous riots in London where they burnt down a department store. Yep. And the whole city just seemed to go crazy.
I know, I just wrote an assignment on those.
It was full on. So I was staying, I was in a terrible relationship.
That was 2011. Yeah.
Yeah, I was in a really, really bad relationship that was in its last days. And I had had an accident in my bedsit. He had moved into my bedsit. This was my life. And I cracked my head on the ceiling because the bed was in the ceiling. You cannot imagine, like friends of mine who saw that apartment are still like, I literally cannot believe you lived like that. And I cracked my head and I had a mild concussion and my partner was not really taking it seriously, was just sort of, you know, having a sook about something. And a friend of mine had one of those moments where she just sensed something was wrong. She called me and she was like, are you okay? I was like, no, I'm not. Like, I've hurt my head and I think I need to see a doctor. And she was like, and she hated him. She was like, I'm going to come and get you and I'm going to take you to a doctor. And she drove across London. She lived in South London. And she was like, I want you to break up with him. He is no good for you. You have hurt your head. You know, this is not on. And was sort of giving me this, you know, intervention. as we drove around, and we couldn't get into a hospital. She was like, I'll take you to Guy's. We couldn't get to Guy's because it was surrounded by barricades and buildings were on fire. And then she tried to take me to Thomas's, and she tried to take me to Lewisham, and we ended up in Kent. Like, we had to drive all the way to Kent and by this stage it was the middle of the night, and I clearly had a concussion, and by this stage I was throwing up and my eyes were bloodshot. She was terrified that I'd had like a hematoma or something. And finally, we could find a hospital where we could get through the barricades and things weren't on fire. But we were driving through London, there was smoke everywhere, and we were watching people loot televisions from Sainsbury's. Me with this head injury in, you know, the last days of this terrible relationship, and this friend of mine going, desperately trying to keep everything under control. And I got some help, but they were like, we can x-ray you, but you'll have to come back in 4 hours because we're treating overflow from London. People have been injured in these riots. And so we went back to where my friend lived in Lewisham. And the street we were on was, there was a mob that was coming down the street. I did an ABC interview about it because the ABC were on Twitter going, is anybody in London? And I was like, I am here and I can hear the rioters. And did this live cross, and the rioters were coming down the street smashing windows one after the other, and you could hear them getting closer and closer and closer and closer, just crowbarring these windows in. And I was like, this is not the London I moved to. Like, what is going on?
That is absolutely fascinating. And just, I mean, geez, I don't know what I would have done in that scenario at all, other than, I don't know, hunker down and stuff. But wow, I don't know how else to cross back to Kate. Kate, what's your question?
It's utterly fascinating because those riots were because the police were racially profiling somebody and killed somebody and then lied about it. So, you know, there was really, it was sparked by righteous anger on the part of the community, but they went like wildfire.
Oh, because it was in the context of the early Cameron period. Mm. And because this was the thing, in 2010, I had my first book come out. I'd written a paranormal young adult novel about witches, which I'm still very proud of. Like, it exists, people can buy it. It's called Burnt Snow. And I'd come back, Cameron got elected, and I think a lot of people were in that place of going, he wears Converse and talks about the environment, he'll be fine. If we're going to have a Tory Prime Minister, he'll be fine. And, you know, people were disillusioned with Labor, who'd been in for so long, and he got elected. And, of course, he wasn't the Converse-wearing environmental saviour. He was a rabid neoliberal who just started to shred the NHS and the welfare state. And it just, things started to fall apart. Like, jobs disappeared. Like I said, the money went from grants, like, all of a sudden they sacked thousands of people. The film industry was defunded. Like, all of these things that people had convinced themselves would be fine were not fine. And there was this anger and confusion that was just running through the city. And they started talking about the bedroom tax. I don't know if you remember the bedroom tax.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that, I mean, it was really terrifying. And you saw that explosion in uses of food banks and suddenly this return to some old school style British poverty. It was happening. And that was, the riots were in the context of that sort of, you know, fear and alarm and this sudden change. And that had started to happen when my book came out. I came back to Australia I was gone for 4 months, and my partner's family, some of them were based in Japan. So we went to Japan and had this like lovely Japan time, came to Australia, went on book tour, put up in all these hotels. This is back in the days you could physically attend writers' festivals. It was all very exciting. And, you know, and me going to high schools, and it was all, you know, Australian and sunny and fun. And we got back to England and we couldn't move back into our flat. And we had subletted a flat from somebody else in the great, you know, London sort of horse trading that goes on around rooms. And it was literally like being in a different country. It was like we left London and come back to a London dystopia. And you could feel it. Like, our first night back after a few months away, there was a different quality. Like, it was just strange. And I secretly started applying for jobs in Australia, like, because I just thought, this, we have no future in this version of London. There are no opportunities.
And now they've added the cherry on top, which is Cameron's crowning achievement, which is Brexit.
Oh, it's a disaster. It's a total disaster. I mean, it's so weird for me because, like, my great, the friends of my youth, my friends from university, my friends from my 20s, they're all still there. And, you know, 3 years ago, my current partner and I were planning a wedding and there was going to be this great big reunion and everybody was going to come over and the world is just completely different. And I spoke to one of my best friends in London a few weeks ago. She's had coronavirus 4 times.
Ouch.
And that's not that unusual. My musical partner's had it twice. He and I did a musical last year because he was in quarantine with coronavirus for weeks. And he was like, might as well write some songs kind of thing. Like, that's where we're at. But it was really, it was such a strange time. And those riots, when I was in my friend's house and we could hear the mob coming down the street, we were 2 stories up in this flat that she had. And I did the interview with the ABC talking about it, going, I am trapped in my friend's apartment. We can't leave the house. We are bunkered down here. And I don't know what is going to happen next. And she came in and in the most English way possible was like, darling, I just want you to know, I've boiled some oil, like in case they come up the windows, I've boiled some oil. And I was just like, I have to get back to Australia. Like, this is not,
ramparts. We're going to throw the oil down.
Is the thing, like in that particular situation, that was an entirely rational response to what was going on. Like, we've got some boiled oil if people do try and like launch themselves up. And I applied for jobs and then around this time is when I got really, really, really sick and ended up in hospital. And by a total miracle, I got a job back in Australia. So I got out. But it was a horrendous way to end what had previously been the most fun 10 years of my life. But it was...
I'll talk about the universe giving you some messages about maybe it's time to get out of Dodge.
Yeah, literally, like, you know, my best friend was telling me to leave him. Then the weather started trying to tell me to leave him, being sick, you know, riots. It's like it was a pretty heavy universal message going, you have got to break up with him. And finally, I heeded it. Not until I actually got to Heathrow and went, what am I doing? And that was it.
Well, that actually leads really nicely into the question that I want to ask you, because it's one that I tend to favour, which is, do you practice self-care? And if you do, what do you do as your practice of self-care?
Well, in former times, my practice of self-care was finding a friend and going, do you have a spare room? I'll be in Chicago in 2 weeks. My form of self-care was always traveling and having another adventure. I don't know if that counts as self-care. I mean, I had a good time. I don't even really know what self-care is. I think self-care for me is blocking people on the internet, which I've become extremely good at.
That's what the block button is for.
I love it. It just changed my life. And I think, you know, I was not prepared for the kind of blowback you get for being a commentator. Like, I genuinely thought when I started writing for The Guardian that I was going to be in this great marketplace of ideas, because I had been a Guardian reader in the UK. Like, I'm pretty much the definition of a Guardian reader, although I did also read The Mirror. And I was sort of, you know, my image of what it meant to be. I had a friend who was a commentator. He was a columnist for The Independent, was a guy who I met through the theatre community. And it was all very highfalutin. Like, I would go out with him and he would meet his other commentator friends and they would have different politics, but they would have these sort of really amazing conversations and we would all have drinks and it was all very exciting. But the Twitter sphere, like, I just wasn't used to waking up with people telling me I was a fat whore who should die. Like, that was really not... I was just like, what is this? And, you know, even today, there's somebody who I think, like, I'm going to call my lawyer, I think. I think I could probably sue them for libel, who's saying things about me that are not true, that arguably legally impugn my reputation kind of thing. And it's just kind of extraordinary, like, this mythology and being turned into a folk villain. You know, there are people on the internet who will swear blind that I, a stranger they have never met or had any encounter with, have done terrible things. And if I wasn't me and I read the things that people say about me and believe them, I would be terrified of me. I would really think I was... Somebody accused me today of worshipping Satan.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a very busy woman. Like, if I've got spare time, I'm going to spend it with a dog. But yeah, it's like... it's
only a dog named Satan, not actual Satan.
It's just... No, Lucifer. No, you worship Lucifer and everyone knows it, this guy. Everyone knows it. So you guys must have got the memo in advance of the podcast recording. But I didn't really know how to take it. Like, the first few years, I sort of thought that the contract was that I had to be open to everybody, and that, you know, that having the column and having the sort of media presence and doing panels and things meant that, you know, I had some kind of democratic responsibility listen to that. And it really, for a couple of years, it got terrible. Like, I ended up in therapy going, I don't understand, like, how am I such an awful person to deserve this?
But of course, the answer is you're not. No. Block early.
You're just a woman with an opinion on the internet.
Yeah, but
very bad.
It was my partner Ben worked it out. Like, he was like, at drama school, do you learn how to take criticism? And I was like, oh my God, yes. Like, at drama school, that's the whole point. Like, on day one, you will sit in a circle and start learning to critique one another, and that's the whole workshop process. And how else do you get any better? And Ben was like, look, the people who are telling you to kill yourself on the internet, they're not trying to make you better. This is not a constructive critical process. Mm-hmm. They are not trying to encourage you to write the great Australian play. They want you to die. And he's like, we do not listen to that criticism. Like, the only influence they have is the influence they have over you and all of those things. But another friend of mine described it as, you know, Twitter is not a democracy. It's, well, social media, it's a republic. And you get to determine
who
gets to participate. And from the point where I really started going, my life is finite, I'm under no obligation to listen to abuse, that's when I sort of got my mental health back. And
that sounds like the very definition of health self-care to me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, let's face it.
Spot on when you jokingly said the block button, but I think that's true.
I think the thing is, you have a right to keep yourself safe, and avoiding distress is a way of keeping yourself safe. And, you know, the other thing I thought, you know, like, because it's like, is criticism valid? Of course it is. But there are different qualities of criticism. Frankly, if I want to know what, like, a hard right person thinks, I'll, like, do a panel with them. You know what I mean? Like, why am I letting...
You ask them. You know plenty of them.
Yeah, yeah. Like, why would I let Jace2x11717 say you're a fat lefty whore when I can probably, like... you know, ask Greg Sheridan or something. You know what I mean? Like, and yeah, so that's sort of been the great revelation that criticism is important, but quality of criticism is really important.
Of course. And the quality part, I think, is the really important part.
Yeah.
So I do have a follow-up question for you. Where did your love for theatre come from?
Lots of things. I always knew I wanted to be a writer, always. That was vocational. So I learned to... My grandfather died 6 weeks before I was born, and my grandmother, I was her transition through that grief, and she read to me. She had a lifelong love of books. My mother was named after Major Barbara, who's the character in a Pearl Buck novel, I think.
Yeah.
And books were really, really, really important in my family, because if you couldn't get a formal education and you didn't have the money to travel, you could at least have this window on the world through books, which were incredibly important. And so I learnt to read very young. Like, I was reading when I was about 3. And my mother one day found me, were in the bank, and I was copying all the words on the, because you had to fill in the deposit slips and things. Remember this? And I was writing open, closed, no smoking, and trying to get the letters right. And my mother realised that I probably had the capacity to learn to write as well. And she had a Remington typewriter that my father had given her when she was, like, temping and things. My father had bought her this typewriter so she would be able to take on jobs and work from home and whatever. And she taught me how to write with the typewriter and pressing my little fingers on the keys so I could make the connection between the letters that I saw in the books that I was learning and what they all look like. And so I learned to type almost, as soon as I was writing, I was typing. And it just meant that I always had that channel for expression. Like I could essentially type faster than I could think, and I could get the words on the page and look at them and go over them. And it just became the way that my brain is wired around words and the construction of words and the mechanical channel of getting them out. And which is pretty weird for an extremely young child to do. And but I just knew that that was me. And when I saw writers on television, I was like, oh, that's what I do. That's what I'm doing. That's my thing. And I became interested in theatre in particular, because I was always obsessed with television. I loved television, and loved films, and from a really young age was like logging reviews of films and making notes of who was in them and things like that. And I mean, this must have been so weird to my parents, because my parents had no, like, just my parents didn't even have middle class friends. Like, I was telling this story the other day, like, the most middle class person my parents knew was a detective in the police force. Like, that was quite posh in our corner of the world. I mean, my dad, worked amongst gamblers and been a bookie and worked at the track, and that was our world. It was like loud club carpet, and everybody was a union member or somebody my parents knew through the Catholic Youth Association and in the burbs, like really burbsy, like really, really burbsy. And my mother ended up with a job in the Department of Education. My dad was out of work a fair bit, as you are in that industry, can be a little unstable. And mum got a temping job in the Department of Education, and they really liked her, and they wanted to, because she was very funny, and my mother's a highly intelligent person, and they wanted her to stay full time. So she took this full time job as an admin person in the Department of Education in, or Ministry of Education, sorry, in New South Wales. And the women she worked with were all feminists. She worked in the policy unit, and they were, these
Yes.
feminist bureaucrats who were essentially going, how do we diversify educational opportunity and that kind of stuff. It was really interesting. Like, it's amazing to think what they were doing. And mum talked about me all the time, and I used to come into the office a bit. And these women my mother worked with, and because mum was like, she wants to be a writer, I don't, how does that happen? Like, how do you get that job? And they were like, oh, look, she might be really interested in the theatre. And I'd had this experience when I was in year 5 or 6. We went to Belvoir Street in Sydney on a
Oh,
school
wow, yeah.
excursion to see a play by Robin Archer called Nicaragua ABC, or the ABC of Nicaragua. And it was a four-hander played by all women. I've never seen anything by all women before. It was totally like no film, no TV. It was entirely women. Like, my God. And it was the story of in post-revolutionary Nicaragua, where the Sandinistas realized that they had this massive literacy problem with all these peasants who they couldn't, they couldn't communicate or get messages through because literacy was so poor. And they sent all of these teenage girls to remote villages across Nicaragua to teach these communities how to read and how to do maths and things. It's a totally amazing piece of history. And Robin Archer wrote this play about it. And the play wasn't just about the literacy program or the, or, class difference or solidarity. But it was also about how the Americans were the bad guys in that particular conflict. And I walked out of that play both knowing I wanted a career in the arts and that I was probably a communist. And my mother very dutifully bought me a copy of the, I came home and I said, I think I'm a communist. And mum went, do you want a copy of the Communist Manifesto? And I said, yes. And she got me the Penguin edition and I read it very dutifully. But my mother's workmates were subscribers to like a women's theatre club, like a feminist theatre club that went off to see feminist plays. And I saw a production of A Doll's House at Belvoir that John Howard was in. And I saw an
Not
extraordinary,
that John Howard, the other
I
John.
was just going to say the only
No,
John Howard I know is probably not an
no,
actor.
there's an actor,
Yeah,
John Howard, who's
not
not
that John
like
Howard,
that John
definitely the
Howard.
other one. And it was just, it that A Doll's House was just amazing. It was amazing. And I was in, like, I understood that I could gain like global travel and incredible insight and you know, intellectual challenge and all of these things just by sitting in a room for 2 hours. And,
you know, so, I mean, you were obviously attracted to go to London, which is obviously, you know, the great centre of stage. Were you not interested to go to New York, which is the other centre?
Oh, well, I've been there too.
You lived in the UK for like a long time.
I went to New York a lot. I mean, London, because the difference was that I have the right of abode because of my impoverished Glaswegian dock worker grandparents. I had I didn't have a British passport, but I had a right to live there and a right to work there. And that was once I'd done my year of exchange on a student visa, I realised that I could go back there. And of course, what happened? So I went to Wollongong Uni to do theatre. I did youth theatre in Sydney, which was totally amazing and fantastic, and met my sort of tribe, and they got me out of the particular kind of bogan burbs Monday to Friday, and then, you know, amazing night adventures with, you know, the drama kids on the weekend, which was a pretty good deal, actually, a lot of velvet hats. And then I went to the University of Wollongong and had the time of my freaking life because it was just like a playground full of all these kids who were just like me, which was just awesome. And then when I did the exchange to England, everything just started to happen for me, because even though I was like making theatre at Wollongong Uni and having a great time and learning and studying and you know, also running around after boys and doing student politics and getting arrested and all the fun stuff, I didn't get any breaks. Like, I didn't have an institutional patron beyond the university, and I didn't even really have contacts in Sydney. I won the prize with the Naked Theatre Company, and that sort of got me so far. But beyond that, I wasn't. I applied to do the playwrights course at NIDA, and I was at NUS National Conference when the interview was on, and it was just a bunch of misconnections. Like, I just didn't have networks in Australia to really get beyond what I'd already done. And then when I did the exchange to England and I sort of had a bit more courage, and I went on my first day there, I went to see the head of the theatre department and sort of tripped over the door landing, fell flat on my face. He was on the phone, and then he had this like prone undergraduate on the carpet. He was like, "Who the hell are you?" And I went, "I'm an aspiring Australian playwright." And he thought that was quite funny and asked if he could see anything I'd written. And I had this play called Kitchen, which I'd got a little bit of Australia Council money. It was like my first grant in Australia to do a development of this play at Theatre South, which was the regional theatre in Wollongong at the time. And the Theatre South had done the development but didn't program it. So I had this script which I owned, and I got about $4,000 for the process, which was enough. I got a scholarship for my exchange, and then I had this little bit of money that enabled me to go to Thailand and do various things. And I gave the head of the theatre department at Sheffield Uni the script, and he went, "Let's see how good you are." And then I got a phone call, and he went, "Yeah, this is great. I think you're really talented." And I've called Michael Grandage, who at the time was the artistic director of Sheffield Theatres, who went on to be the artistic director of the Don Meyer's, like one of the most famous theatre directors in the world. And my lecturer knew him and passed this script to him. And Grandage went, "Oh, this kid's pretty good." And, you know, and my lecturer thought I was hilarious because I was like this ridiculous Australian, like, you know, wearing ridiculous University of Wollongong clothes, you know, around, you know, my boots and my, you know, leathers and the rest of it, and a bandana around my head, like looking like a Grateful Dead fan, as was the fashion at the time in Wollongong. You know, in Sheffield, where all the kids were into clubbing and dance music and all wore, you know, the latest trainers and whatever. I mean, they all thought I was a complete freak, and he thought I was quite funny. So Grandage said, "Look, if the kids want to form a company and do the show, they can have a venue at Sheffield Theatres for free, and we'll sponsor their development and the rest of it." And it just all started happening really quickly. Like, all of a sudden, I had, because there were some really ambitious kids who were doing drama at Sheffield Uni, and they were like, "Yeah, we'll do it with Michael Grandage. He'll come and see the show and he'll support it and the rest of it. We're there, no problem." And they did the show, and I came back, I went travelling and then I came back to Australia and I got a phone call from them saying, we're going to take it to Edinburgh. I was like, what? Like the Edinburgh Festival? Like, really? Is that a thing? And they were like, yeah, we're totally doing it. And one of these kids literally maxed out like £10,000 on his credit card in raw faith that he could make a go of this show. And I went travelling again. I went travelling through America and got to Edinburgh. And he met me at the airport at like 2 o'clock in the morning, and my plane had been delayed, and I'd been in New York like the week before and had unspeakable adventures in New York, quite a good time. And he was holding up this sign saying, Edinburgh welcomes famous Australian playwright Van Badham. I was like, James, I'm not famous. He went, you are now. See all these people? They are all here for the festival and they all know your name. And he just blagged it. Like, he convinced people that I was famous and convinced people I was this big deal. And suddenly I was going to like Edinburgh things with really powerful theatre identities, like really powerful theatre critics and the whole show. And because I was weird and foreign and a bit funny, people thought I was interesting, and I got invited to more parties and more panels and the rest of it. And it just really took off for me. And I got, the show was a hit. It sold out. It was wall-to-wall 4-star reviews. And then everybody wanted to talk to me. I got a phone call from the Royal Court saying, do you want to do, that's the big theatre in Chelsea, one of the most influential theatres in the world, saying, do you want to do a program with us and the BBC? And the BBC will teach you how to write for radio. And I was like, yes. And I came back to Australia and I was like, what am I doing here? Like, I came back to Australia, the phone didn't ring. I was, you know, not really knowing how to contact theatre companies. And I realised that my opportunities were in the UK. So I got the visa and I went back again. And I told my poor boyfriend, Australian boyfriend at the time, I was like, I'm going to do Edinburgh again. I'll only be there for 3 months. And of course, I got offered residencies and then more shows and more people were interested and things just blew up for me. And I made a deal with myself that I wouldn't come back to Australia until the work ran out. And that took me to other places. Like, I did really big shows in Germany. I got a German agent and a bunch of my stuff went into translation. I met these mad Icelandic guys who did shows of mine in Reykjavik. And then I got a phone call one day saying, are you busy? Do you want to come to New York and do the Summer Play Festival? We'll be able to pay you an honorarium and put you up in a hotel for the whole thing and give you an
Which interview. Of course you say hell yes to.
Yeah, and I literally got the phone call. It was one of the weeks I was sleeping behind the couch at Johnny Bolina's house. And I was like, well, yeah, I'd love to go to the New York Summer Play Festival. Like, what is that? And it's like this major festival for emerging artists sponsored by one of the biggest producers in New York, and everybody goes and you meet everybody. And I got a commission from the Wilma Theatre in Philadelphia, and it was just, yeah, it was totally amazing.
It sounds incredible. It's like this whole miasma of stuff that sort of convinced you to keep going.
Yeah.
And to sort of reinvest in your own self and your own career path. And I guess my other question for you on that is, bearing in mind we're in the wilderness of 2 years effectively of COVID times, what advice would you have for any budding playwright or writer or woman who is considering whether or not theatre is the right career path for them, particularly given that the last 2 years has been so hard?
I think I would say, if you're not prepared to set everything on fire, it's not the life for you. I mean, this is the thing, like, it's hard. Like, it's really hard being an artist. Being a good artist is even harder. And and the job is to aspire for greatness. You may never get there. But I remember reading an essay about the ecology of the arts is that it takes like 1,000 playwrights to make one Brecht. And Shakespeare did not exist in a vacuum. You know, there's no individual genius. Like, the generational genius who pops up is part of an ecology which is made by people who won't get the glory and may not be remembered, but whose presence and engagement, like, feeds that channel for greatness, you know. And that really stuck with me, that it was that I may never be the artist I want to be, but if I keep working and work as hard as I can, I might be part of the generational ecology that produces somebody who is great. And that's enough. Like, that's enough to make your life worthwhile. I mean, wouldn't you love to be able to say that you're one of Breck's friends? Like, that'd be great, you know? But I realized very young that meant things were going to be different for me. They were going to be different. And that I, particularly because I came from a family without money or contacts, that it would be hard. It would be really, really hard. And a lot of it would be awkward. And that I just had to keep going and remind myself that we have a saying on my side of politics, which is no one ever dies. You know, like, as long as you are alive, your capacity for resurrection is infinite. And I've sort of approached my career in the arts in the same way. Like, it is really difficult, and you don't get to have the things the other kids have. Like, and I sort of remember when I went to England the first time, when I was just about to go off to university there, my partner at the time and I stayed the night at my mother's house. And my mother lived in my grandmother's house, which was like a World War II John Curtin special. It was like a house and land package for returning service people. And it was that asset of that house that enabled me 3 generations later to be able to go to university, you know, like that kind of security around that house. My mother was living in it with my dad and had been caring for my grandmother at the time. And I had the most visceral nightmare. Like, I had this, by this stage, I had this lovely boyfriend, and he and I had been living together in Bulleye, and we got offered the house in Bulleye. We'd been renting it, and the owners offered it to us for like $200,000, and he was becoming an academic and he'd just got his first academic job, and he was like, we could do this, we could buy this house. And I was like, I can't, like, I have another calling. Like, I have to try and do this thing with my career. And the night before I got on the plane, I had this nightmare that I was being chased by zombies, and I sat up in bed, and then I heard the window smash behind my head and the zombies crawled through, and I was still sleeping, but I had one of those nightmares. And I knew on a fundamental level that the life that I'd sort of had in Wollongong, which was really nice, you know, with my super nice boyfriend and my cute little house that they'd offered to sell to us. And I had a PhD scholarship at the time, and I was sort of on that academic track as well. And I could have had that life and all those things, but I knew I just had to try. Like, and obviously that relationship eventually broke up. And he said to me, I know that if you don't leave me, you will resent me for the rest of your life.
Right.
And it was true. Like, it was true. Fortunately, many years later, we are good friends, and his partner is very nice and he has very nice children. I'm very happy he's got that life. But I just, it just wasn't me. And I could see the appeal. I could see the appeal. And so many of my friends were building these like professional careers and earning money and buying houses and having kids.
So what kept you going then? What kept you thinking, no, I'm not going to take that very obvious pathway of staying in Wollongong and buying that $200,000 house and having that life? And what pushed you to make that call to say, nope, still going to go and do the crazy thing?
I think, one, it's just the way I'm wired. I'm very much the Kirk in most of the really close relationships I'm in. Like, my partner, my manager, my best friends in the world, they're all Spock. They're all Spock types. They're all logical.
The engineers.
And, you know, it's that cartoon of Spock going, don't do the thing, and Kirk going, I'm going to do the thing. I'm definitely the Kirk in all my relationships. But a lot of it had to do with my parents. Like, my parents had no breaks. They had no breaks at all. And, you know, my dad's dad died in a tuberculosis hospital when he was 3. The only memory dad had of him was through a plastic wall. It was really hard for my dad had to leave school. He had been a footballer and he was trying to have a professional football career. He was injured and blinded, and that was the end of his football career. And then he eventually got his sight back, but it was never the same, and it was all over by that point. He had to get a job and immigrated to Australia and the whole thing. And that was when he was, what, 16? And my mother was the same. She had to leave school. There was, you know, the only education she got was at business school. She was really interesting, my mother, because she travelled and she worked out how to travel because she had that sense of adventure. And it's interesting. So my mother was diagnosed with cancer 8 months ago, and with terminal cancer. And we are going through that process where my mother is looking back over her life and has, like things that she wishes she could have done. But the things she did do with her life were incredible for what she was offered, just amazing. And so what we did was when I was in the house, because we were trapped there together, with my mother with a terminal cancer diagnosis and me separated from my house and my partner and my dog and everything else. Thank you, Gladys Berejiklian, and well done. And we decided that we would buy travel posters, vintage travel posters of all the places my mother had been in her life. And we made like this extraordinary list. Of all these, I mean, she went to Sri Lanka and she went to Nagasaki in the 1960s, and she
That's
went to,
incredible.
she went to Egypt and she lived in Canada, and she went rowing on Lake Geneva. Like, she did these just amazing things, and she was just this girl, and she had earned the money for her passage by working days in an office, and she worked nights in a mail sorting room, like things like that. That was the kind of
That's badass.
Yeah, she was
But
the kind of person she was.
it sounds to me like she really gave she gave you that as a gift, as a gift to you, and that may have influenced you quite considerably.
Oh, well, my mother used to tell these extraordinary stories of the places she'd been when I was a kid. I just have to plug the computer in, which everybody loves hearing during a podcast recording. But you did
Sorry.
assure me it
Low
was
production value,
Wi-Fi.
as I mentioned previously.
Yeah. So my mother did give me that sense that, you take the opportunities that you get. And they both had an enormous sense of frustration. Like, my dad wanted to, I mean, my dad loved sport like no other human being in the world has ever loved sport. And he wanted to be a sports journalist after his injury. And he was a really good writer, my dad. Like, he was really talented and wrote the most amazing letters. Like, I'm so lucky I have the collection of emails that my father sent me in the 10 years I lived overseas. They're quite extraordinary. And then my mother wanted to be a doctor, and she only actually told me this like in the last few years, but it was just so beyond what anybody would facilitate for her. She really wanted to be a pediatrician. That's what she wanted to do with her life. And she went nursing, and she had that issue where she was a highly intelligent woman, denied the opportunities that had been given to far less intelligent men who ordered her around and treated her like garbage. And my mother tells this story about she was the person in the surgical theatre who had to pick up all the blood-soaked rags. They have some name for it, back in the day. And the doctors were throwing them at her, like, so she would be hit with these like
What?
blood-soaked. Yeah, and I was just, it's kind of an extraordinary thing. So she
You make me
left
angry just to
nursing, and
support.
she did other things with her life. And my mother's whole thing with me was like, I just want you to be a good person, and I want you to be happy, and there's no expectation. Like, your father and I want you to get the education you want. I mean, must have been so weird for them, like my aspirational working class parents, who, whenever I was interested in something, they just moved heaven and earth to try and facilitate it in whatever way they could. Even if they didn't understand it, they would try and sort of back me in. And dad came to all of my bizarre, like, avant-garde feminist plays, and I don't think he understood a freaking word of them, but he always came. And
That that's true support. That's what I love.
and my dad, who could tell you, I had an ex who once said, I could probably tell you who's in the who like who's in the Portuguese national team now, but your dad can literally tell me who was playing in the Portuguese league in like 1968. Like, he had the most encyclopedic knowledge of sport. It was completely
Oh,
insane.
seriously, my dad was the same. He would be able to tell you from not just football, but right through to cricket and almost through to Tiddlywinks.
Yeah.
Who was playing in the national team at any particular time?
It was amazing. My father only ever got one sporting question wrong in Trivial Pursuit his entire life, and it was about knitting. and my mother would bring it up all the time, and it was like, it's awesome, great time for him. But they had been so frustrated that if I had a dream, that was that we were doing it, that was it. So when I got my marks for year 12 and had miraculously done better than I had expected, and I announced that I was not actually going to do the law degree that I think my father really wanted me to do, I explained that I was going off to do avant-garde theatre practice at the University of Wollongong, and they were like, okay, all right, that's what we're doing, I guess, so no problem kind of thing, which was really incredibly generous of them because I had literally no idea what that would involve, and frankly, neither did I.
No idea what it was, I suspect.
No, not really, and no, they didn't, but they, like I said, they facilitated it and came to everything and were those kind of parents that they just did what they could and cut their cloth as best they could from what they had. And and I think that was the thing, like, because my parents invested in that for me, like with time and attention and encouragement.
It's
and
worth
that I just
money
thought,
I reckon
huh
I reckon it's worth more than money.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is the thing. Like, I went to state school. I'm really proud I went to state school. I'm really proud I went to a regional university. I'm really proud that I went to a regional university in the UK. And I've met lots of people who had very privileged experiences. When I was at Lambda, I taught four kids with titles, which was very weird. Very weird. But they were, they were lovely. And you can imagine their manners were impeccable. But, you know, I know for a fact that my education is as good as anybody's, like, because I professionally associate with people who've been to other institutions.
Oh, and a million percent. So I also am a state school kid back in the UK. And I'll give you just as a slight sort of random extra thing, which you probably already know, in the UK, other than if you went to Oxford or Cambridge, and that you're an Eton kind of person, literally outside of that school system, most people don't actually have the same vernacular. Most kids will go to a state school, or they will, you know, kind of go to a school and then head to a university where the privilege that oftentimes gets associated with British schools, it does exist. I'm not saying it doesn't, but for the vast majority of us, we don't see it. And we don't see it and we don't hear about it. It's not part of our lives. So I was part of the generation of kids that was the last to not have to pay to go to university. Sure, it was still means tested. So my parents still had to chip in a little bit to pay for books and what have you. But it was beautiful because you're in and around a bunch of kids who are just like you and not like you at all, and you got to learn so much from that experience, and I loved it. I thought it was fascinating and beautiful, and I'm really grateful that I got that experience.
Yeah, I mean, I had such a I really do think that I was really lucky because I sort of came in at the end and was enrolled in my degree before Howard put all the hex increased all the hex to the point where a lot of working class families were like, why are you going to saddle yourself with a massive debt on a career that's not going to return you? And my mother had those kind of, it turned out, things my mother told me years after they happened, when I was about 14, 15, my mother had spoken to my art teacher at school going, look, Ben is creative, and her father and I are really worried about what that's going to mean. Like,
how will she support herself?
Yeah, how will she support herself? And my mother was like, my mother had gone off and done some research and found out what artists earned. And the art teacher was like, Barbara, you know, some kids are just like this and you've just got to trust her. Like, if that's where she's going, let her go there and she'll find her own way. I mean, it was really hard. And I mean, I remember when I was at Lambda and I was teaching these kids at Lambda, I was all of 28 or something. And my kids were like 21, 22. And I went out with them one night, and they were spending, like, because Lambda, you had to have the dollars to go to Lambda. And back in the day, it's different now. They actually have public places and stuff, but it was pretty full on. But they were buying drinks with 50-pound notes. I'd never seen a 50-pound note before. And these were my
I've
students.
never seen a 50-pound note.
I was hilarious. And I was just like, and this was at Roof Gardens in Kensington, which is an extremely posh bar, which I don't think I would have been let into if I wasn't with them. It was literally hilarious. And we were in like a silk pavilion. They had these at the Roof Gardens, they have these sort of British Raj style silk pavilions, or they used to. And I was just like, how on earth did I get here? And I realized it was really funny. I was with my Lambda students one night, and one of them had an Australian friend. And they were like, oh, you must know one another because only 17 people live in Australia, like kind of thing. And this woman was just horrified that I was there because she could hear from my accent that I was this total bogan. And it was just, it was like she wanted to warn them, like, you know, this woman,
She's not one of us, not one of
she's
us.
not one of us. And I always found it really hilarious. My best friend, who is literally the poshest person in England, she was like, the thing I love about you, Van, is you have absolutely no manners, and I feel under absolutely no obligation to have any either. And I was like, thanks, Tab.
And that is probably a really good place for us to end this lovely conversation.
Well, I
It's
hope it's
been a
been
delight to chat
interesting.
with you, Van.
My life by me. Yes, I think we got up to, what did we get up to? 2011. That's what we
But you
did.
know, it was really interesting because it's a whole side of you that I had no idea really existed. And I'm really sorry. I should have thought about that more, but I didn't. I'm a bad person,
You're
maybe.
not a bad person. It's the internet. It's glib. We're all glib there.
Yeah.
You know? But no, it's all right. It's okay. It's all
Hey, it
right.
was great to learn more about your background, Van, and thank you for sharing it with us. It's
Oh,
just
that was fun. I mean, I'm just obviously off on one. There's so many things I don't want to talk about today. So I'm just going to talk about me going to the UK and having a good time.
Well, that is
How's that?
excellent. And thank you very much. Bye, everyone. Don't forget to like us and leave a good review.